Well, good afternoon, brethren. Welcome to Sabbath services. Today we are ready for Ezra chapter 4. My wife and I were talking about the Ezra Bible studies last night, and we came to the conclusion that they've been a little bit too pedantic. So since no one knows what that word means, I took it as a real compliment. So we'll do our best to jump into chapter 4. There's more story starting in chapter 4 and onward, so it should be a bit more interesting as we go along. At least, we hope so. What is interesting about Ezra chapter 4 is that it starts out with angry, sneaky people. That always provides for a very interesting story. In verse 1, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard the children of the captivity built the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief fathers and said to them. Now we'll pause there. Who's being discussed? First of all, remember that it's Judah and Benjamin. These were the Jews. Judah and Benjamin basically came to be called the Jewish people. It did not include the other 10 tribes, only a portion of Levi. But the other 10 tribes had already been scattered, were already gone. Judah and Benjamin were the ones that came back and occupied the land. It says there were adversaries. We know from the start of this story that these were not friendly people, although they make a very friendly statement. They made it look like they wanted what's best. So they said, let us, in the middle of verse 2, build with you. Let's do this together. Now we're already told that they're enemies, they're adversaries. So what was going on here? Very likely they were being sneaky and underhanded. We'll give you some help here for a couple purposes. Either to sabotage the operation, to slow things down, or to help build in such a way that they knew all the defenses so they could come and destroy it possibly later on if they not needed to or wanted to. They went on to say, we seek your God as you do. We're the same as you are. And we do sacrifice to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asshur, which brought us up here. So they're saying ever since we were transported here and they were brought from Babylon and areas like that, we continue to sacrifice to Yahweh. Now, what was the problem with that? Wouldn't you want to welcome others who are doing exactly the same thing? Well, the problem was they weren't doing exactly the same thing. They had some things in common, but they had quite a few things that were very different. The Samaritans were called syncretists. That means they blended together elements of lots of different religions into the worship of the true God. Some of them may have worshipped the true God in part, but they also worshipped Baal or Marduk or other gods of the region. So they were half-breed religionists, we might say. They put these things together. So they certainly didn't want this kind of help. The Jews didn't want this kind of help. So the first tack that the enemy takes, which belies their underlying motive, their motive was to stop work on the temple, to slow down work at the very least. Their first plan is to infiltrate and overcome in that way. Satan's approach often is to infiltrate and cause problems within the ranks. And that then slows or stops the progress of God's work. And it sounds strikingly like Paul's description of Satan the devil, when he said Satan appears as what? An angel of light. So it's no great thing if his ministers appear as ministers of righteousness. So here's the same attack. We appear to be friendly. We're all in this together. But what's the idea? We want to stop this so that we remain superior in the area. Now, these people definitely still had historical memories of the superiority of both Israel and Judah in this region. So they certainly didn't want to see that kind of power brought back to the area. These enemies claimed to be alike in every way, and maybe to some casual observers they were. But Samaritans, as we said, worshiped their own gods as well as a type of the worship of Yahweh. Verse 3, Zerubbabel and Jeshua, who was the high priest, and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel, said to them, "You have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God." Now, to us, in the King James language, that sounds like a pretty stern rebuff. I don't want anything to do with you people. That's not quite the way it was stated. What they were in essence stating was really fairly polite but direct, that we've been given this responsibility by the king to rebuild this temple, and so you're not a part of this. Here's the decree, here's the document that says, you guys here, the exiles, go back, build a house. So he goes on to say, you have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build it unto the Lord God of Israel, the eternal God of Israel, as King Cyrus of Persia has commanded us. So it was very stern, but direct, and yet not rude, just saying this is our responsibility. Now, underlying that statement is clear understanding that we do not want anything to do with the Samaritans because of this blended religion. And again, sometimes people think, well, we just have all religions together, and we're all going to the same place, and we all believe basically the same thing. Well, there's God, and we believe that, don't you? Yes, see how much we have in common? Why can't we just all get together in the name of the great God and work together? Well, it's just not possible for some of these same reasons. These Jews understood that this would be the same path that led them into captivity to begin with, compromising with God's truth and working together, accepting beliefs that were not godly, were not scriptural, into their practice. They had done that before. God simply labels that idolatry. So by blending themselves with the Samaritans, they'd be compromising with the true worship of God. So they tried to be tactful, stated that the king had given them the job. The Samaritans were not a part of that. And so they simply rebuffed the offer. Of course, with that, the opposition becomes a little more direct. And all of a sudden, the Mr. Nice Guy approach, hey, that we have all this in common, we'll work together with you on this project. The Mr. Nice Guy approach disappears, and the boxing gloves come out, which is often the case with enemies. They'll appear to be pleasant on the surface, on the outside, but underneath are the boxing gloves. In fact, we might say the boxing gloves come off, and it's bare knuckles after that. Verse 4. The people of the land, then, I should say, the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in the building. In other words, since they weren't allowed to help with the building, they failed to infiltrate, they take a more direct approach. They actively work to discourage the Jews and make them afraid through intimidation. The phrase, weaken the hands, simply means to discourage. The opposite idiom in the Hebrew is to strengthen the hands of someone or to encourage them. So we can weaken others and discourage them, or we can strengthen others by encouraging them. It says they troubled them in the building. No details are given at this moment as to exactly how that was done. We'll see some of the details as we go along. How did they weaken the hands? How did they discourage the Jews in the building? But it also says they troubled them. The word troubled in the Hebrew means to be anxious, to be disturbed, to be afraid, to be terrified. So we might say that there were acts of terrorism as well. Now, we're not told exactly what was done, but we know from the accounts in Nehemiah that later on they would have to actually guard the workers who would build a wall around the city. They'd have to defend them with sword and with spear and with arrow because there were terrorist attacks, guerrilla attacks going on to stop the building of the wall later on. So these kinds of things may have been going on at this time as well. So how were they discouraged? In verse 5, they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose. Now, you ever wonder why lawyers have bad reputations? Not all lawyers, I'm sure there are one or two. No, I'm just teasing. They hired, in essence, consultants, liars, lawyers, counselors to represent the Samaritans in the Persian court, to go to the king or the king's court and simply say, here's what these Jews are doing. They hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So we're talking maybe a decade and a half, 14 or 15 years probably. Darius, by the way, the king of Persia here is Darius the First. That's not the same Darius the Mede that preceded Cyrus. So two different Dariuses. As is often the case with kings, they use each other's names every generation or two. It's George the First, George the Second, then Edward the First, then George the Third, then Edward the Second, then George the Fourth, and you can never keep track of it. And that's often the case with these ancient kings as well. So different Darius than Darius the Mede. Nonetheless, can you imagine constantly fighting these lawsuits? Completely ridiculous accusations, constantly going out, and now you've got to take the time to back up and say, no, that's not what's happening. So it gets so frustrating after a time to have to deal with that. And it's discouraging. And frankly, it's often very expensive to do that as well. So they hired the best lawyers of their day, or counselors, expert individuals, to represent their cause against the Jews in the Persian court. And this throws emotional roadblocks in front of the project. They didn't physically stop them at first, but they emotionally handcuffed them, slowed them down. They got so discouraged, they had to wonder, is it even worth it to continue to have this constant? We're still able to do sacrifices without the temple. Do we even have to go forward with this? You'll find over the course of time, less and less desire to have the temple built, and more simple acceptance that apparently it's never going to be built. So later on, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah are used by God to snap some sense into these people, wake them up. You've been given a job, you've got to get it done. And I think at times it's important for us to realize that troubles in our life, here these troubles, these frustrated purposes took place over a period of 15 years probably. And in our lives, sometimes trials that are discouraging are sometimes allowed to continue for a long time. It's just the nature of things. At times, that's difficult for us to deal with because we have trouble seeing the benefit of this, and it gets very discouraging. But God can use these trials, these troubles, these long-term issues to teach us faith, to teach us reliance on Him, to teach others how to help and to serve in long-term difficulties. It certainly can teach us patience toward others when we have constant enemies that are constantly causing troubles and difficulties. So God would use this circumstance, I'm sure, for the Jews, just as He does often in our lives, to teach us how to deal with long-term disappointments or difficulties. If we go on to verse 6, "And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem." So Cyrus passes from the scene. The next king comes on, and we won't take the time to go through whom exactly is being talked about. There are some scholars that believe titles like Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes and Xerxes are actually kingly titles like the Pharaoh. So it could be any one number of individuals involved. But I'll tell you, people can obsess over exactly who is this being talked about. And there's lots of different interesting theories. Josephus has an interesting theory. It's the minority opinion. Doesn't necessarily matter. But we'll just simply say that here's now comes kind of the climax of this constant nagging difficulty. Constantly going before the king of Persia and saying, here's what's going on. Here's what the Jews are doing. They're a rebellious lot. They're kind of snotty. You're gonna regret allowing them to build this temple and build their city. They're going to come back and bite you. You just got to be aware that this is the kind of people they are. So regardless of kings are being referred to. I think the reason Ezra records this is because here's an example of the kind of constant discouragement that was going on. God allowed these enemies to continue for more than a decade in the opposition of building the temple and the walls later on of the city. In verse 8, it says, Rehum the chancellor and Shimshai the scribe wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes king in this sort. So here's the letter. The letter writing campaign is sound and solid. The Samaritans have the ear of somebody in the royal court, and they want to get this message across. Verse 9, then wrote Rehum the chancellor, Shimshai the scribe, and the rest of their companions, and I won't even attempt to pronounce all of their names. We'll just call them the boys. Verse 10, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Asnapar brought over and set in the cities of Samaria, and the rest that are on this side at such a time. In other words, they're simply saying, everybody who is imported to this area sees it the same way, except these pesky Jews. These people are a problem. Verse 11, this is a copy of the letter they sent unto him, even to Artaxerxes the king. Your servants, of course, you pour it on. You know, we are humble servants. We're happy to be under tribute to this great empire and receive the benefits that we receive. Everybody on this side of the river at this time, be it known to the king, verse 12, that the Jews which came up from you to us are come to Jerusalem. They're building the rebellious and bad city. There's something about this ground that when you build a city here, it turns people evil. And then on top of that, to have these people do it is going to be a problem here. They've set up the walls thereof. They've joined the foundations. It's rising up out of the ground. It's going to cause you problems. Verse 13, be it known now to the king that if this city be builded and the walls set up again, then they will not pay toll, tribute, and custom, and you shall endamage the revenue of the kings. Now, it's interesting that the Samaritans, first of all, say, you know, we're a lot more like you than they are. We're kind of kin, but these Jews are not. And then they say, what's the second most important thing? Money. You're not going to get the money. These people are rebellious by nature. Now, that was one thing they did have correct, unfortunately, but not necessarily in this way. You're not going to get the money. And again, the idea was they're going to grow to power. They're going to take over our areas. They're going to require tribute from us, and we will not be able to pay you either. So verse 14, now because we have maintenance from the king's palace, and it was not meet for us to see the king's dishonor, therefore we sent and certified the king that search may be made in the books of the records of your fathers. And you shall find in the book of the records and know that this city is a rebellious city. Now pause there for a second. Did they really think that of all the Persian records, that somebody was just going to sit down with all these books and start paging through them to see where they could find the history of Jerusalem? Or do you think they had somebody there who'd already done this research, who had it very clear? And when the king says, you know, we ought to check the books to see what it says about Jerusalem. Oh, I just happen to have page 674 of the history of Palestine. Of course, it wouldn't be called Palestine back then. The history of Judea. And here's what it says. They are bad people. Obviously, we're talking about a conspiracy of sorts going on here. Connections. It's human nature. It's politics. It's the way things work in the world. So you shall, in the book of the records, in the middle of verse 15, you'll know that this city is a rebellious city and hurtful unto kings and provinces, and that they have moved sedition within the same of old time, for which cause this city was destroyed. So this is a bad place, bad people. You're making a serious mistake if you let them rebuild. Verse 16, we certify the king that if this city be built again and the walls thereof set up, By this means you shall have no portion on this side of the river. It's kind of a reference back to David and Solomon's time, when David and Solomon's kingdom ruled all this region, including Samaria and Syria and all the other areas surrounding this area. Verse 17. And now again, here's the Jews, small group of people, 50, 60,000, 70,000 maybe. Small city, only half built. They're going to take over the whole region? I don't think so. But it depends on who you give your ear to. Who will you listen to? It's a great lesson as well. Who should we listen to? Verse 17. Then sent the king an answer to Rehum, the chancellor, to Shimsham, the scribe, and to the boys, the rest of their companions that dwelt in Samaria, and unto the rest beyond the river, peace, and at such a time. The letter which you send unto us has been plainly read before me, and I commanded, and search has been made, and is found that this city of old time has made insurrection against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made therein. You're absolutely right. Probably referring back to the final three kings of Judah before they went into Babylonian captivity. They did try to break away from Babylon, not pay tribute, etc. So there was, as always, some truth to the issue. Verse 20. There have been mighty kings over Jerusalem, which have ruled over all countries beyond the river, and toll, tribute, and custom was paid to them, primarily Solomon and those who might immediately follow him. Verse 21, give you now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not built until another commandment shall be given from me. Now pause there for a moment. You see at least some wisdom in this ruler saying, from what I have exposure to at this point, I think you're absolutely right. Don't let them continue building. Send emissaries, tell them to stop on my behalf. But he does leave an out by saying, until commandment comes from me. In other words, he seemed to be wise enough to know that he didn't have all the facts yet. What he had looked pretty bad for Jerusalem and for the Jewish people. But he realized he may not have the whole story yet. So he left that door open until another commandment comes from me. So at least he was wise enough to know that when there are politics involved, sometimes people don't give the whole story. If they were to give the whole story about the history of Judah in this area, they would have realized that most of the time, Judah was pretty insignificant in the region. Didn't rule the whole region. They squabbled so much and sinned so much, God didn't let them rule much of the region for much of the time. So verse 22, take heed now that you fail not to do this. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the kings? Just in case you're right, I want this building to stop right now. So talk about how to discourage a people. Now, verse 23. When the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribe and the boys, their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem. They got on their horse immediately because they were delighted about this. Why? It would keep them superior to the Jews, and that's what they wanted. It was simple human, you know, self-preservation, self-interest. They went up immediately in haste to Jerusalem, to the Jews, and made them cease by force and power. They didn't send a messenger, you know, who read the message. The king says stop. The whole entourage, army and all, came to encamp at Jerusalem. Said, you have to stop now. We have an order by the king of Persia. Verse 24. Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So we're talking, you know, 10, 12, 14, 15 total years when the building simply would not go forward. It would stop. So they were discouraged. And as we probably could pick up from areas like Zechariah, like Haggai, it became clear that most people got very comfortable with the idea that the temple never would be built, that it simply wasn't ever going to be reconstructed. And again, they probably got comfortable with the fact that, well, you know, we can still offer sacrifices on the altar. We don't have to have the temple completed to do that. We can still get by. And again, Haggai and Zechariah would have to stir them all up to get this to change. Verse 1 of chapter 5. Then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Now, we won't take the time to go to portions, but if you'd like to, you can certainly read all of Haggai and a good portion of the first several chapters of Zechariah, and you'll certainly see that they're spurring people on. You've got to do something. You cannot be content without building the temple of God. You might be afraid of others, but where is your respect for God? Where is your honor toward God? So they said, they prophesied to the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Again, pause there for a second. You have Jews and Israel used in the same sentence. Jews were only one small part of Israel, but they worshiped the God of all of Israel. So they're called, or God is called the God of Israel here. But it was the Jews who were primarily responsible. So, verse 2, then rose Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God which is at Jerusalem. And with them were the prophets of God helping them. Now you read some of Zechariah and Haggai, and they were mad. And they said angry things. And they told it like it was. But God calls that, through the pen of Ezra, helping them. Sometimes help is not necessarily with a smile. Sometimes help has to be, stop that. You've got to do something different. And of course, that applies in general terms in the church. It certainly applies at times in parenting, where we'd love to do everything parenting with a smile. But sometimes our children need, stop that, sit down, don't do that, that's not acceptable, etc., etc. So the prophets were in one sense like loving parents, telling it like it needed to be told for the good of the people. So, verse 3, at the same time came Tatnai, governor on this side of the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions. I will not try to pronounce that twice. Shethar-Boznai. Kind of flows off the tongue. Shethar-Boznai. Practice those things for hours. No, I'm kidding. But he said to them, who has commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? Wait a second. Where do you get the authority to start this building program? We didn't get the memo. So verse 4, in other words, still opposition coming. Then said we unto them after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building? Can you see the intimidation here? First thing they do, the police come up to your car. What do they ask for? Can I see your driver's license? I want to know your name, buddy. Stop you on the street, not that this has ever happened to me. What's your name? What's your name? It's an intimidation factor that I'm going to find out who you are, and I'm taking your name to somebody that can do something about this. It's a threat in that sense. So who are you people? What's your name? Verse 5. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease. In other words, they did not give in to this intimidation. They were inspired by the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah, and they were going to finish this job. So they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius. And then they returned this by letter concerning this matter. So they gave an answer. Now we'll pause here for a second. Just a bit of the history involved. Why, during the reign of Darius, did this whole thing kick back into gear? There was godly reasons, spiritual reasons. Haggai and Zechariah were used to stir the people up. But it's also interesting that it waited until Darius the first became king. When Darius was king, and there's lots of history behind the Persian Empire and how it developed, but when Darius was given the throne, there were rebellions all over the Persian Empire. it is often the case in historical terms when a new individual sits on the throne, everybody who's either under tribute or has been oppressed sees it as the opportunity to test the waters, maybe break free. So there were rebellions of major or minor proportions going on all over the Persian Empire. So in the great scheme of things, how important was this 60,000 or 80,000 people in this little bitty city in the middle of the Middle East there? It wasn't very important at all by comparison to some of the things that Darius was dealing with. So would Darius want people on his side? Yeah, just like Cyrus did. If I let these people build their temple, they'll be much more dispossessed to like me and to be under tribute than they would otherwise possibly. So nonetheless, this goes all the way to Darius, to the king. The copy of the letter that Tatnai, governor of this side of the river, and Shethar-Boznai and his companions, the rest of them, the boys, sent to the king. They sent a letter to him wherein was written, verse 7, unto Darius, king, all peace, be it known to the king that we went into the province of Judea to the house of the great God, which is builded with great stones and timber is laid in the walls, and this work goes fast on and prospers in their hands. It's really going fast. Why was it going fast? Again, the people were united at this point. They were excited by the prophecies and frankly sometimes scared by the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah. And so they wanted to get this done. They felt they were insulting God by not having moved forward with this. Verse 9, then asked we those elders and said unto them, thus, who command you to build this house to make up these walls? We asked their names also to certify you that we might write the names of the men that were the chief of them. And thus they returned us answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and build the house that was built these many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and set up. That would have been Solomon. But after that, our fathers provoked the God of heaven unto wrath, and he gave them under the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed his house, this house, and carried the people away into Babylon. But in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus made a decree to build this house of God. And the vessels also, gold, silver, the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought into the temple of Babylon, those did Cyrus, king, take out of the temple of Babylon. They were delivered unto this one, whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. Pretty accurate retelling of the story. He got it right. And, verse 15, said to him, take the vessels, go carry them to the temple that's in Jerusalem. Let the house of God be built in this place. Then came the same Sheshbazzar and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since that time, even till now, has it been in building and yet is not finished. Now, therefore, if it seem good to the king, let there be search made in the king's treasure house, which is there at Babylon, whether it be so, that a decree was made of Cyrus the king to build this house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send his pleasure to us concerning this matter. So they send the letter. They say, tell us what's going on. Is this real or is it not? Now I'll pause for a second. Who was, when Cyrus took over, who was there? Who was prime minister, in essence, of Babylon? Well, Joseph. I'm sorry, Daniel. Let's put Joseph a couple thousand years ahead of time. Daniel was. Would it seem reasonable that Daniel would have brought others into his administration that were of his people? Well, it's very possible. In fact, there are many Hebrew names in records during this period of Babylon. So is it possible that those Jews, like Daniel, very much may have been familiar with things? We speculated before that Daniel might have even had records of the temple articles that were put in storage so that they would know exactly what to bring out and send back to Jerusalem. Because certainly Daniel knew the prophecies that there would be a return once they repented, once God forgave them, once the 70 years were fulfilled. So could there be Jews at this moment in administrative positions in Cyrus's government or in Darius's government now that could serve in this area? Of course that's possible. How could this be done so quickly with so many records? So God certainly was involved with that. Let's go ahead into chapter 6 then. We know that the letter goes into Darius, verse 1 of chapter 6. Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in the house of the rolls where the treasures were laid up in Babylon. And there was found at Akmatha, the palace that is in the province of the Medes, a roll, and therein was a record written. And we won't take the time to read through that, but it simply says, yes, there was a decree. It gives us more detail than we've had before about that decree. The decree before simply said, go build a house. This decree actually says some of the size dimensions, some of the ways it ought to be built, how large in essence it can be. Three rows, verse 4, of great stones and a row of new timber. Let the expenses be given out of the king's house. In other words, Cyrus said, I want tax dollars paying for this project. This is a public works project. Now, the people that had raised the question, what was their intent? Their intent was to stop the work. Who do you think you are building this temple? So they write, we're going to write the king. Well, again, intimidation, fine, write the king, you know. Write the king, see what happens. So their desire is to get it stopped. They do the research and they find out, you know, tax dollars are supposed to be paying for this project. And tax dollars have not been spent on this project. So the people that are trying to get the project stopped now have to cough up the money to complete the project. So talk about God turning things around. When someone intends evil upon you, God can turn it around for good. Verse 5, let the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took forth out of the temple, which is at Jerusalem, be restored again to the temple, which is at Jerusalem, everyone to his place, and place him in the house of God. Now therefore, Tatnai, governor beyond the river, Shethar-Boznai, and your companions, and the rest of the folks, verse 7, let the work on this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build the house of God in this place. Moreover, I make a decree that you shall do to the elders of the Jews for the building of the house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river, forthwith expenses be given to these men, that they be not hindered. So take the money out of the royal taxes that are being collected from this area, pay for this house to be built. Verse 9. And that which they have need of, both young bullocks and rams and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, oil, according to the appointment of the priests which are at Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail. So not only money to complete the temple, but all the supplies to carry out the sacrifices in the system that God had set up. That they may offer sacrifices, verse 10, of sweet savor to the God of heaven, and pray for the life of the king and his sons. Not only do I want you paying for this stuff, you better pray for these guys every day. Pray for me. You better do it. Verse 11. Also I have made a decree that whosoever shall alter this word, you know what, you're not going to rebel against this command, let timber be pulled down from his house, and being set up, let him be hanged thereon. And let his house be made a dunghill for this. Now, unless you were really brave or completely insane, you probably would not want to cross that threshold. You want to follow what the king says. It would be a very good idea. Verse 12, and the God that has caused his name to dwell there, destroy all kings and people that shall put to their hand to alter and destroy this house of God, which is at Jerusalem. I, Darius, have made a decree. Let it be done with speed. So again, they intended harm. God turned it around very similarly to the days of Esther, when one individual intended harm and God turned it around to be a great salvation to his people. Verse 13, Tatnai, governor on this side of the river, Shethar-Boznai and their companions, according to that which Darius the king had sent, so they did speedily. You have this kind of threat. You know, I like my water closet being a small room in my house. I don't want the whole house turned into a restroom, a dunghill. No, I don't want that. Verse 14, the elders of the Jews built, they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They built, they finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. So basically in 4 years, they were able to now conclude. They had the inspiration from Haggai and Zechariah. They had finances from the kingdom of Persia. They had workmen, and the job got finished. We would understand this date to be March 12th, 1515 B.C. So restoration of the temple takes place. Now what we'll do is we'll pick up with verse 15 and onward next time and talk much more about the reinstitution of the holy days and how the observance of the Passover was actually done differently from Ezra's time onward than it had been done before. But we don't have time to cover that today, so we'll pick it up with chapter 6 and verse 15 next time.